A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Kind of have a dual track here on the show today. We are going to give you some legislative updates. We were talking, you know, a lot this session about what's going on in Virginia, and yesterday was another busy day in both the House and the Senate, unfortunately. But there are a number of states out there beyond the Commonwealth that we're following, and there's good news and bad news to report from those states. We're going to get to that. But I also want to talk about, you know, we've been discussing a lot about U.S. versus Hamani this week, the case challenging the federal prohibition on gun possession for unlawful users of drugs. There was another, I think, pretty important presentation, not before the U.S. Supreme Court, but before the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts this week, dealing with the Second Amendment rights of young adults. Now, the Supreme Court is holding on to, I think it's five cases that deal with that issue. They have not granted cert to any of them. They've not denied any of them outright. They've been holding on to them for months now. My expectation is that, they're holding on to these cases because something, they say, in either Wolford versus Lopez or U.S. versus Hamani may impact those cases. So I expect that those cases are going to be granted cert, but the lower court decision is vacated, and the cases remanded back to lower courts in light of the Supreme Court's findings in either Wolford versus Lopez or U.S. versus Hamani. Which is another way of saying the court's going to kick this can down the road, at least a couple of years. But this is an issue that's not going to go away at both the federal or the state level. And in Massachusetts, this case that the Supreme Judicial Court heard involves an individual named Mickey Thompson, who was 20 years old at the time. This was 5 years ago, 2021. He was charged with assaulting a state trooper and carrying a firearm without a license. He was basically pulled over for running a red light. Allegedly knocked that trooper down, then ran away. Allegedly ditched his semi-automatic pistol, which was found in a driveway after he was apprehended. The trial judge told the jury that individuals younger than 21 not eligible to carry firearms in the state of Massachusetts. But his attorneys argue that that is a violation of his Second Amendment protections. So, during oral arguments on Monday this week, his attorney, Catherine Hayne Lazar, argued that the instructions were erroneous because it was based on an unconstitutional statute that prevents young adults from exercising their Second Amendment rights. According to Courthouse News Service, several judges questioned not whether the statute was unconstitutional, but whether Thompson was in the wrong for never having applied for a license at all. Associate Judge Dalila Arguez Winland said, well, he might have been denied a license for other reasons. I just have no idea. And the problem for you is that your client has to show standing. I think that's a bit of an absurd argument to make. Why would anybody go through the process of applying for a license when the state law says they're not allowed to have one? Why would you spend the money? Why would you waste your time? Why would you do any of those things, knowing ahead of time that the answer is going to be no? That seems like a really unreasonable argument that in order to have standing, you would have had to apply for a license that you knew you weren't going to get. Essentially, only those who are trying to challenge the Constitution out of the law ahead of time would be those who have standing. Now, again, I'm not suggesting that Mickey Thompson is a Second Amendment advocate. I think it sounds to me like he's using a Second Amendment argument to try to avoid criminal culpability. But that does not mean that he doesn't have a Second Amendment right, or that other 18, 19, and 20-year-olds don't have Second Amendment rights. I just think it's silly to suggest that only those who have applied for a license that they know they'll be denied would have standing to challenge the statute. Lazar argued that the statute in question was incorrectly applied, at least to him, saying that early Massachusetts laws don't support the historic tradition of restricting firearms from young adults, minors. And again, perhaps in 1776 or in 1791, 20-year-olds were considered minors. But they're certainly not considered minors today. It's not like Mickey Thompson was charged in juvenile court with these crimes. He was charged as an adult, because in the eyes of the law, he is an adult. But Lazar argued that, you know, this, I mean, even back in the day, the evidence from the founding shows that 18-year-olds were expected, and in some cases required, to bear arms as part of their service in a militia. She also noted that the statutes cited by Massachusetts don't support a tradition of prohibiting firearm possession based on age. The regulations from the 1850s that the state cited talk only about the transfer and sale of firearms, not the possession of firearms. And she said this does not a historical tradition make. According to Courthouse News, Massachusetts Assistant District Attorney Ian McLean argued otherwise, noting that militia regulations of the nation's founding allowed minors to possess firearms, but that parents had to give firearms to the youths who were still considered under their parents' control. And again, I think that's a red herring of an argument, because we're not talking about minors. Now, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has adopted basically the same argument. In a challenge, NRA versus Glass, the 11th Circuit said, well, I mean, if you look back to 1791, 18, 19, 20-year-olds were considered minors in terms of contract law, right? They couldn't enter into contracts because they were considered minors. So that's enough of an analog to the ban on gun sales for 18, 19, and 20-year-old adults because, you know, a sale is a type of contract. Again, regardless of what the age of majority was in 1791, it is 18 today. And so to say, well, because there were some laws that limited 18, 19, and 20-year-olds 250 years ago from possessing firearms, or not even possessing firearms, from entering into contracts, that we have to consider these adults as minors, but only when it comes to their Second Amendment rights. Again, to me, that is just as absurd as arguing, well, you can't challenge the permitting law in Massachusetts unless you apply for a license, knowing you're going to be denied. Common sense tells us that 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds today are adults. The law tells us that 18, 19, and 20-year-olds today are adults, whatever they were considered back in 1791. And you know, the Supreme Court noted, hey, listen, back in 1791, handguns may have been considered dangerous and unusual, but they're not dangerous and unusual today, and so they can't be prohibited under the Constitution. So if it's true that firearms that might have been considered unprotected by the Second Amendment 234 years ago, it can be constitutional today. Well, it stands to reason that somebody who may have been prohibited from owning a firearm or purchasing a firearm in 1791, because they were still considered a minor, would not be prohibited today from purchasing a firearm because now they're considered an adult. So I think the courts are getting a little too cute with some of these arguments. And that would include the arguments that we heard again earlier this week in Massachusetts. Courthouse News goes on to say that several judges inquired whether the cited state laws that regulated firearms are true analogs to the present day law. McLean argued that the laws of the nation's founding had an age restriction applying to 16-year-olds possessing firearms. And he said they don't have to be historical twins, they just have to be analogs. Associate Justice Scott Kafker said, well, age may have some limitations surrounding it, but a categorical ban could be unconstitutional, noting previous historical analogs contemplated minors possessing firearms, albeit that possession being regulated. And again, McLean once again stressed that Mickey Thompson never tried to get a license in the first place, therefore has no standing to challenge the constitutionality of the law. He says, we don't want people just flouting laws because they think they shouldn't apply to them, and then coming up with a post hoc justification. Again, unless you truly expect somebody to waste their time, to waste their money on a fool's errand, they have no expectation that they're going to sue over this, right? But that maybe one day in the future, they might possess a firearm without a license. So they should go ahead and apply for a license. They know they're going to be denied so that in the future, if they're caught with a gun, they can then argue that the law is unconstitutional. I mean, that's just patently absurd. It is patently absurd. I do wonder, though, if that is not going to be the argument that the court adopts, that it doesn't have to wrestle with the notion that an adult today, fully vested in every other enumerated right, when Mickey Thompson was arrested, he was read his Miranda rights, right? He was told, hey, listen, you've got a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. That applies to Mickey Thompson at age 20. He had a Fourth Amendment right to be secure in his property against unreasonable searches and seizures. He had a First Amendment right to tell the cop to go F off. Now, he didn't have the right to knock the cop down and then run away. But Mickey Thompson, at age 20 in Massachusetts, possessed every enumerated right contained in the Constitution, with the exception of the right to keep and bear arms. Now, the text of the Second Amendment talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms, right? It doesn't say the right of adults, although that may be assumed, but it is the right of the people. Didn't say the right of 21-year-olds, those 21 and older. Didn't say those 21 and older, but under the age of 65. There's no age limit put on this at all. It's the right of the people to keep and bear arms that shall not be infringed. So who are the people? The Supreme Court has suggested that the people are members of the political community, at the very least. Mickey Thompson, at age 20, is a member of the political community, right? He could vote in the state of Massachusetts. He could serve on a jury. Fully vested not only with the enumerated rights in the Constitution, but also fully required to partake in all of the responsibilities that adult citizens may be required to undertake. So I just don't think you can make this carve out for one right in our Constitution. That's the one right that doesn't kick in until 21 or maybe until 25 when our brains are fully formed. You can't do that and remain constitutionally compliant. So if the Supreme Judicial Court decides to dodge this issue, just as the Supreme Court has decided to kick this can down the road, Mickey Thompson's conviction is likely to stand. But that phrase, the law is an ass, I think we'll have another perfect example based on the SJC's decision. All right. So let's talk about some of the other legislation going on around the country. I did write a piece for Bearing Arms earlier today going through all of the gun control bills in Virginia that are likely to be signed into law, so I would refer you to that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here on that. I will say that sine die in Virginia is March 14th. A number of gun control bills have already been sent to Governor Abigail Spanberger. She's not acted on any of them. I suspect that she is waiting until the entire package gets to her desk, and then she'll have a big signing ceremony. All the gun control groups are going to be invited. And yes, she'll be signing a gun and magazine ban into law that is expected to take effect on July 1st, unless, again, a court stops that from taking place, which if that's going to happen, it's going to be, I think, at the state level, because the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has already upheld Maryland's ban on so-called assault. And so I think that they would, I think the courts are going to be kind of hamstrung, at least at the federal district court levels, on that decision. But anyway, if you want more talk and more details about what's going on in Virginia, I would refer you to that story at bearingarms.com. So let's talk about what's going on elsewhere around the country. Today, the New Hampshire House is expected to vote on House Bill 1108, which would broaden the circumstances under which a gun owner can raise an affirmative defense to displaying a firearm. Not necessarily using a firearm, but displaying a firearm in response to the reasonable belief that their life is being threatened. As NRA's Institute for Legislative Action points out, New Hampshire's in an open constitutional carry state, so you can open or concealed carry without a permit. They say that those policies have helped make New Hampshire one of the safest states in the nation, and that this bill would enhance the deterrent effect that law-abiding gun owners have on criminal conduct. We are also watching the campus carry bill in New Hampshire that has passed out of its House of Origin, I believe that it was the House, and is over on the Senate side, but don't have any new news in particular on that bill. We also have some hearings in Alaska today. Senate Bill 243, which would remove suppressors from the controlled weapons list. Senate Bill 203, which regulates firearm accessories. This one, according to NRA ILA, could create complications for persons who lawfully possess parts in accordance with existing law. So they want to implement a state-level statute that's similar to federal law that deals with devices that can allow a handgun to fire more than one round per trigger pull. And again, how that's defined matters, because, you know, the ATF has said that things like force reset triggers, the ATF has said now that force reset triggers do not qualify as machine guns. The ATF did say that bump stocks qualified as machine guns, but that was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. We are still seeing states, including, sadly, I mean, states that have a pretty good record in terms of Second Amendment issues, like Alaska, try to regulate these devices as if they are, in fact, machine guns. So that's Senate Bill 203. Oregon, interesting news out of Oregon. And I did write about this yesterday, but in case you missed it. So there was that bill we've been talking about, House Bill 4145 in Oregon, making some changes to the Measure 114. Right. We talked with Tony Aiello about this last week on Cam & Company, the attorney representing the plaintiffs in the state-level challenge to Measure 114. And among the provisions of House Bill 4145, this is the bill, by the way, that the sponsor didn't like the fact that a fellow Democrat voted against an amended version of his bill in committee. And so he stopped the committee hearing, hauled her out into the hallway, berated her for 20 minutes to the point that she was allegedly left in tears. She switched her vote, but she complained afterwards that her colleague had created a hostile work environment. This is that bill. So the good news is that the Senate, Senate committee, basically gutted the language of House Bill 4145. So the increase in the cost of applying for a permit to purchase, which would have gone from $65 to $150. That was wiped out. The provision in House Bill 4145 that would have given licensing authorities 2 months to issue a permit to purchase a firearm, that was scrapped as well. The only portion of House Bill 4145 that survived the Senate committee markup was the portion of the bill that extends the start date, the effective date of Measure 114, to January 1, 2028. And remember, as Tony Aiello told us last week, right now Measure 114 is under an injunction. On paper, it is set to go into effect, I think, March 14th, a little more than a week from now. But that's not likely to happen. The measure is still pending a decision by the Oregon State Supreme Court. They heard oral arguments back, I think it was in November. And as of right now, the law is still subject to an injunction issued by a Harney County judge. So if and when the Oregon Supreme Court comes out with a decision, let's say they say, yeah, the law can go into effect. If House Bill 4145 is not passed and has not been signed into law by the governor, let's say they come out next Tuesday with that decision, it is possible that the law could take effect later this month. I suspect, though, that if the Supreme Court did issue a decision to that effect, let's say, you know, next Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, right before this deadline, you would see a mad scramble to pass House Bill 4145 because, frankly, the infrastructure isn't there. The state has had since 2022 to come up with a system to operate this permit-to-purchase scheme, and they haven't done so. This is still not ready for prime time, which is why they're trying to kick this can down the road. And so I think that is a bit of good news. You know, we also have the federal court challenge to Measure 114, but that's on hold pending the Supreme Court's resolution of Duncan versus Bonta. That is California's ban on large capacity magazines. That has been heard in conference by the Supreme Court a number of times this session. It is slated once again for review this Friday, I believe. And my hope at this point, I'll be honest with you, I don't have much expectation the Supreme Court is going to take a hardware ban case, at least not before the Third Circuit issues its decision on New Jersey's gun and magazine bans, which is likely to cause that circuit court split. And I think that's what the court's waiting for. But my hope is that they're going to hang on to these cases, the mag ban cases, the hardware ban cases out of Cook County, Illinois, and Connecticut, that have also been heard in conference. Just hang on to them. Don't reject cert. Just keep them there in limbo. Because if the Supreme Court does outright reject these cases, let's say they just reject cert for Duncan versus Bonta, sure, that allows the federal case to continue in Oregon. But the Ninth Circuit's decision that these types of magazine bans are constitutional would remain in effect, which would present a big challenge to those hoping to overturn the Oregon law. And in California, it would mean that the state is now free to start enforcing the ban on possessing these large capacity magazines. So I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court, again, you know, I'd love to see him grant cert, but I'm hoping that they take no action at all, because I just don't see a cert grant likely at this point. All right. One other bill that or one other issue that we should talk about in Minnesota. The good news is Tim Walz's gun control agenda does not appear to be advancing at all right now. Certainly on the House side, where Republicans and Democrats are tied, you need a Republican to cross over, and that has not happened with any gun control bills. Interestingly, the Senate really hasn't started moving much on gun control bills. That's where the Democrats have, I believe, a one-seat majority. But there's very much an open question about how at least two state senators would vote on these measures. So they're playing some political games here by trying to put Republicans on the record in the House instead of bringing these bills up for the Senate, where they might get defeated. And then they can't blame Republicans for the defeat, because Democrats would have a hand in the defeat of this legislation, right? But on later today, the House State Government Finance and Policy Committee is holding a hearing on House File 3357, which would ban all firearms from the Capitol complex. In fact, that started just a short time before I sat down to record this this program today. Again, yeah, this is a House bill, so they do need a Republican to cross over and vote in favor. This is one issue that I'm a little concerned about. Because even in pro-gun states, like in Oklahoma this session, there was a bill that would have allowed concealed carry in the Capitol complex. You've got a Republican supermajority in the legislature, and yet lawmakers voted down that bill. They voted to keep the Capitol complex gun-free. So it is possible, unfortunately, that we can get a Republican to cross over and to vote to ban firearms from the Capitol complex. As of right now, if you have a concealed carry permit, you can carry. There are magnetometers at the entrances to the state capitol. So, you know, you do have to go through. You have to declare your firearm. But you can carry. And I think that's the way that it should be. I do not like the people's house being a place where you cannot exercise your fundamental civil rights. So we'll keep an eye on what's going on with the House File 3357. We'll give you updates on all these bills coming up next week. Just a quick programming note, by the way, I'm going to be off next Monday. We don't do a show on Friday, so the next Variant Arms Camera Company will be next Tuesday. But we're going to have you up to date on everything going on at variantarms.com as well. All right, now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Indianapolis, Indiana. Feds charge Fountain Square shooter after state drops case. So the reason why the state dropped the case of this individual, I believe a 19-year-old, 18-year-old, Shaquille Ferguson, who was accused of shooting people in Fountain Square. I'm sorry, I said this was Indianapolis. This was actually Cincinnati, Ohio. My apologies. Was that prosecutors determined he acted in self-defense. The problem for Shaquille Ferguson is that, once again, we're not talking about a Boy Scout here, right? So he is, at 18, already a convicted felon. Now, he could have been charged under state law with possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. I'm not sure why he was not. But he has now been charged with possessing ammunition as a prohibited person under federal law. Fox 19 in Cincinnati reports that investigators recovered three 9mm shell casings where Ferguson fired in Fountain Square, but they did not find the gun that he used to shoot a 19-year-old in the leg and a 16-year-old who was grazed by a bullet. The affidavit says that's because he fled the area and later turned himself into police. Again, the shooting itself was considered an act of self-defense. So the charges of shooting were dropped at that point. Fox 19, though, reports that in addition to the criminal charges that led him to becoming a felon, this was aggravated assault was the charge. He pistol whipped somebody on a Metro bus and was then sentenced to probation, by the way, for that felony crime. He is also accused of using the same gun that he used in the Fountain Square shooting 2 days prior to that, accused of shooting into a car and shooting a man inside that vehicle. So he's facing felonious assault charges and some other charges in state court, in addition now to the federal charges. So, you know, again, this is somebody who acted in self-defense, apparently, in one shooting, acted offensively in other shootings. And, you know, this stems from the fact that he got probation for that violent felony, feloniously assaulting somebody on a bus. Why would you give him probation for that? Why not at least, you know, a year in prison? Why the slap on the wrist? And if Ferguson had been sentenced to prison after he pled guilty to that crime on July 23rd, 2025, he would not have been out on the street in October of 2025. When he, again, allegedly shot these two individuals in self-defense and then shot somebody allegedly not in self-defense a couple of days earlier. The police chief in Cincinnati was actually put on paid administrative leave after this Fountain Square shooting. The city manager wanted an investigation into the effectiveness of her leadership. I don't know all the details about the police chief, but I would argue that if that's going to be the case, should be investigated in the prosecutor's office too. Why offer, maybe the judge, but why offer a plea deal to this individual that would allow them to walk away with nothing more than probation? So we'll keep our eyes on that story and now the federal charges that this individual is facing. On to today's Armed Citizen story, which also deals with an individual well-known to police. Albuquerque burglary suspect who's linked to 15 break-ins faces new charges. Now, police got their big break in this case because the burglar was shot by a business owner after he was caught in the act. Joseph Montoya, accused of breaking into a card-collecting shop in Northeast Albuquerque. I believe we talked about this at the time. There was actually a neighboring business owner, so it wasn't the card shop owner, as I think was originally reported, but it was a neighboring business owner who saw the break-in, confronted Montoya, was in fear for his life, ended up shooting Montoya, and according to KOB in Albuquerque, police have now linked Montoya to multiple burglaries at card collector shops, cell phone stores, toy stores, a flower shop, They say that over a 6-week period, he is responsible for at least 15 burglaries, with police saying that he stole hundreds, if not thousands of dollars worth of items each and every time. Prosecutors are trying to keep Montoya in jail until there's a trial. And again, were it not for that armed citizen, he might still be out and about committing more of these burglaries. Now, I suppose it's possible he could have been caught somewhere down the line. But again, it was that armed citizen, that business owner who saw what was going on, confronted Montoya, and then acted in self-defense that led police to discover that, oh, this is the guy who's been responsible for all of these burglaries. And again, this speaks to a basic fact about crime in the United States, that a very, very small percentage of individuals responsible for a outsized number of violent crimes. It is rare for somebody to conduct a single burglary and then, I'm never going to do that again. I'm not saying it doesn't ever happen. I mean, it's pretty uncommon. Even in terms of violent crimes, we know that as little as 1% of a city's population, this is according to one study, you can find it at the DOJ's website, 1% of a city's population can be responsible for as much as 63% of violent crime in a community. Which again makes the whole idea of, well, let's just make every act of possession of a particular firearm, or let's pass a law that imposes a broad net of criminality over every gun owner, not only unconstitutional, but completely ineffective in terms of public safety. You want to really impact public safety, go after the people who are committing the crimes. Go after that 1% of the city's population. Don't go after the 99% of legal gun owners who will never commit a violent crime. But that's why gun control, oh, they talk about public safety, but it's not really about public safety. It's, again, about reducing the number of Americans who can exercise this fundamental right and eventually turning that right into a privilege itself. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A blacksmith at Charlestown Races in Charlestown, West Virginia, who was able to save a man's life with some help, by the way, I should say. The headline, I think, is maybe a little misleading because it sounds like this really was a team effort. But Elias Meehan, certainly deserving of praise. He works at Charlestown Races in West Virginia. And it was about a week ago, February 26th. He's actually shoeing a horse, and he sees a fellow blacksmith run out in between the barns, and he said he knew that there was trouble. So he ran over to help. Two barns over, there was a guy whose name has not been released. He had been preparing to hold a horse for the other blacksmith when all of a sudden he just collapsed face down and kind of hit a stall door. By the time Meehan got there, he was unconscious, he was unresponsive, he wasn't breathing. A woman named Catherine Hannigan had already started chest compressions with the assistance of two other grooms there. But Meehan, who was trained in CPR, took over, continued those chest compressions for about 10 minutes until EMS arrived. He said, it was kind of fast and slow motion, right? Like, it felt like it took forever, but at the same time, you're caught in that moment. He said he was standing 1 minute, just hit the ground. Says luckily he made it to the hospital. He's home now, and he should be making a full recovery. According to the Pollock report, which was the first and so far as I'm aware, the only outlet to report on this, one source said that if it were not for the work done by these individuals before the EMS arrived, that he would not have likely survived. Meehan, he said he was just using the training that he learned while in school at the James Rumsey Technical Institute. He said, I didn't expect any recognition for this. He said he went back to work afterwards, shod six more horses that afternoon. He said, I did go and visit him at the hospital. So a lot of his family messaged me to thank me and stuff like that. He said, I feel kind of bad about the entire thing. People are giving me honors over his bad luck. Elias's mom, Elizabeth Meehan, said, you know, he utilized the CPR instead of panicking. She said, anybody can become certified, but can you actually use it when you have to in an emergency situation? And that is true. Some people will freeze up. But thankfully, that was not the case with Elias Meehan, Catherine Hannigan, the other grooms there at the Charlestown races, all of them not just in the right place at the right time, but willing and able to do the right thing to help a coworker in need. And again, sounds like they not just saved the day, but they saved the man's life. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again next Tuesday. But again, be sure to check out BearingArms.com every day between now and then. We're going to be keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And there is a lot of news and information from all across the nation these days. So be sure to check that out. If you like what you see, we'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, VIP Platinum member. All you have to do, go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. You can learn more about each level of support. But use the promo code FIGHT and you can take 60% off your membership, no matter what tier of support you choose. And no matter what tier of support you choose, you're going to be supporting the work we're doing in arms, and I cannot thank you enough for that. So, again, bearingarms.com/subscribe, promo code FIGHT, and, well, you know the rest. Have a great rest of your week and a good weekend as well. Looking forward to seeing you back here again on a 2A Tuesday. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.